From the McKinsey Global Institute, it's Forward Thinking with Michael Chewy and Janet Bush.
Michael, when you think about measuring inequality, what metrics come to mind?
Well, the obvious ones would be income within countries and relative per capita GDP amongst countries. And then there are metrics about different educational provision and attainment, which might signal inequality both of opportunity and outcomes. And of course, there's the Gini coefficient. I'm sure there are many more.
Yes, those are the ones that would initially come to my mind. But actually, our guest today has been measuring the bumpiness of roads as a measure of what he calls infrastructure inequality. So in the United States, it's fascinating, he's found that African Americans ride on bumpier roads than white Americans.
Oh, aye. Well, I certainly haven't come across an analysis like that before. We can't wait to hear what else he has to say.
So welcome to the podcast, Ed.
It's wonderful to be here, Janet.
I think you would describe yourself as an economist who specializes in cities.
For sure.
What route took you to that specialism?
Well, I can give you three distinct answers to that question. All are true in their various ways. The first route is that I grew up in New York City during the 1970s. It was a time in which the city had lost its way, in which it felt as if it was headed for the trash heap of history. And then it staged something of a comeback in the 1980s. And I found that absolutely fascinating. I found the New York around me to be an amazing place, full of opportunity and full of peril. And I naturally wanted to understand that better. Then there's the familial explanation, which is my father was an architectural historian, a curator at the Museum of Modern Art. My mom ran capital markets for Mobil Oil. And so naturally, I became an economist who studied cities. The third explanation, which probably has the largest weight on it, is that in the 1980s in Chicago, at the University of Chicago, Paul Romer and Bob Lucas were pushing forward the new growth theory. And the new growth theory, in a particularly dazzling piece of brilliance of Paul Romer's, right, was based on the idea that there were spillovers across people. That meant that we lived in an increasing returns to scale economy that could continue to grow. But those increasing returns were only compatible with our normal markets if they were external to the firm, if they were spillovers. And so that led Lucas, when he thought about these things, to think about what Jane Jacobs wrote about in the 1960s in The Economy of Cities, when she talked about how we learn from people around us, back to what Alfred Marshall, the great English economist, was talking about in the 19th century when he wrote that in dense clusters, the mysteries of the trade become no mystery, but are, as it were, in the air. And this led to a rekindling of interest in cities. And from there, I became an urban economist. And, you know, it's been a wonderful 35-year existence of studying humanity's amazing metropolitan areas.
Cities work because of scale benefits and agglomeration and network effect. Are those the key things?
All of those things we would call different versions of agglomeration economies. And ultimately, at their root, agglomeration economies are about the elimination of transportation costs for goods, for people, for ideas. Network effects are just the benefits that we get to being linked to other people. And so that's again, an elimination of transportation costs. And so they're part of agglomeration economies. Similarly, the scale economies, whether or not it's the scale of my own operation or in cities, often the advantage of being able to take care of common infrastructure, like a common port, a common airport, that's also an example of an agglomeration economy. So, and of course, agglomeration economies also exist because we learn from people around us, right? I mean, that's very much that Alfred Marshall view, or because labor markets function better, or because product markets function better. All of these things have at different points in time played smaller or larger roles in making cities dynamic economically.
But there's something magic about people being together, isn't there? I mean, you, I believe, spent some time in Mumbai, a city that I know, and you described it as a magical experience. And what did you love about it?
Oh, I think I just love the extent to which, you know, people were trying to find new things. People were coming from areas of enormous poverty, and they weren't living in some luxurious urban existence, but there was a future, there was a promise there. The sense of collaboration was amazing. The sense of creativity was amazing. I thought it was a fabulous experience. And it's interesting how, like, poverty and hope, right, are not necessarily opposites. I mean, Mumbai felt to me, say, for example, in the area of Dharavi, which I spent some time walking around, it felt like that was a place in which poverty was just infused with hope. And it's just felt very different from like many of let's say America's low income areas, where it felt as if, you know, hope had departed.
Do you notice differences between developing world cities, which clearly are, you know, at the forefront of urbanization these days? Are they developing in a different way?
Well, there are sort of particular things that were true of much of Western economic development, which I think were sort of freakish in us, not so much that it's unusual that it's not going in them. For example, Western urbanization was very linked to industrialization. That was a very unique moment in history that happened to occur, because in fact, heavy industry is actually a very bad match to urban density. It doesn't require urban density. It, you know, creates bad things for people who live around you, right? It's not a natural fit at all. It was sort of a weird 150-year period where they sort of coincided, but it's not at all natural. And of course, in many developing world cities, industry isn't particularly evident today. Other things are often the same. I would say like the Anglo-American experience is particularly intense in rule of law around property. So there is an Anglo-American tradition of spending 1,000 years sorting out exactly the way that property title works in different areas. And that title had been largely worked out for rural settings by the time we started to do mass urbanization. That made the process of building up London, building up New York on the property side very orderly. Now, I don't want to overstate. It's not that our rule of law was so extraordinary, right? America was corrupt in the 19th century in a level that, you know, no developing world city today has anything on, you know, our boys when it comes to like bribing and corrupting city governments. Nor do I want to suggest that they were particularly safe in terms of you know, the personal safety. I mean, these were murder rates in 19th century New York were also very high. And, you know, Jack the Ripper haunted the streets of London. You know, surely far, far more safety would be found in Mumbai today than would be found in New York in the 19th century. But this particular era of like land law was something that you know, Western cities were very good at. And that made it easy to sort of assemble large-scale properties that you would then develop for rental units. And that was one aspect that really is different. It's a big issue in terms of developing world cities today is the difficulty of regulating housing markets and regulating land and assembling land and so forth. And there's also, particularly again, while we're on Mumbai, the sort of strangeness of right, not necessarily having great title to everything, having lots of informal areas where we have no idea what's going on, while as soon as anything becomes formal, we're going to regulate the heck out of it, and we're going to have very limited floor area ratios, whereas the 19th century US or London rules were very different, which is, you know, we have very well-established land law, but we don't have a lot of regulations preventing you from building up.
So that's a very interesting contrast. Looking at China's growth miracle owes a lot to high investment in cities and unlocking the value of land to finance those investments. I mean, could other emerging economies learn from that?
Well, certainly urbanization has been a big part of China, Korea, Japan. All of these areas, urbanization has played a role in it. I would think looking at Korea in the 60s and 70s might seem like a more natural place for many of the developing world places to look rather than China per se. In general, like East Asia, of course, has been an amazing success story, both in terms of you know, GDP growth and in terms of management of cities. I mean, looking at Seoul is usually a pretty sensible thing to do, and certainly looking at Singapore is a sensible thing to do.
Let's talk about the pandemic. Has the pandemic had a lasting effect on cities? And if so, what is it? What's changed? Or it may be temporary.
So certainly, are we still living in a hangover from the pandemic? For sure. The most obvious thing that's changed is we have not sorted out our commercial real estate markets at all, right? So we have still, you know, vastly reduced levels of people going back into the office in various places. That's the most difficult thing, whether or not that's in Wall Street or Canary Wharf. I mean, these very large concentrated office markets are particularly vulnerable because by their very definition, they involve a heck of a commute because they're not well integrated with residential housing. And consequently, people don't want to necessarily do that. And so if you give them a chance to work from home, they're going to want to take that option. That's a challenge. Now, you know, As an economist, I tend to think the way these things will work is that prices will fall, occupancy will go back up, the product gets used. Maybe it doesn't get used quite as intensively as it did before, but it does get used. So I don't know that that's a permanent challenge. I think it does create a good 5 to 10 years of pain in a lot of prime office markets, though, and that does translate into lower commercial tax revenues. The view that this makes an urban doom loop automatic is, I think, a mistake, in part because property tax rates are flexible. And if the base value of commercial property goes down, people are willing to pay to fight crime. It's not like you can't make the case to voters, as New York's leaders did in the 1980s and 1990s, that you need to raise property tax rates in order to finance public safety. So I think that's a challenge. I don't know if there's anything else which is as obvious as that. I do continue to think that there is a conflict between the very footloose nature of talent in an age of Zoom, where it's not so much that I'm concerned about the, we're all just going to dial it in from our basements. It's more that companies can relocate to Florida or relocate to Texas, or I don't know what exactly the equivalent is in the UK option. It's UK is funny because London is just such a huge magnet for everything that it becomes much harder to. I mean, you also don't have the same level of differences in either tax rates or climate across the UK. Whereas in the US context, moving from Chicago to Florida was a very real thing, and a lot of firms did so. And that's both a tax rate and a safety issue and a climate issue. And then that collides against the pre-COVID, progressive sense that cities were, failing along a number of key dimensions in terms of caring for their least fortunate members. So that's the lack of upward mobility, particularly in American big cities. That's the high level of housing unaffordability. That's the fact that America locks up a lot of young men and treats a lot of other people fairly brutally in the process of policing. All of these are things which ran up against, we wanted to do more. We understandably wanted to do more. We should do more. But if you try to solve your social problems by either taxing the rich or letting crime get out of control, the rich will leave. And you're not able to handle things. And that's exactly what we saw in the 1970s, where the increased mobility of talent, the increased mobility of companies because of container ships and highways and suburbanization ran up against big city mayors like John Lindsay of New York or Kavanaugh in Detroit, who wanted to solve real social problems, but the rich just left. And I was worried about this playing out. I think we're only going to see if it does play out going forward.
So MGI wrote a report recently called Empty Spaces, Hybrid Places, isn't it? And it looked at this office attendance being stable at about 30% below pre-pandemic levels. But there is a possibility that there will be a hybrid model that persists. So what would a hybrid building of the future look like?
So the sensible hybrid model might be that, firms somehow or other share space. The problem with the hybrid model reducing demand for real estate is typically when companies say, you can take 1 to 2 days off, they actually want people in the office at the same time. So unless they can figure out some way to share across companies, that doesn't lead to much of a reduction in footprint. And as we know, and I'm sure McKinsey itself, I suspect, in its pre-pandemic era, most management consulting firms managed to have huge numbers of their personnel out of the office many days a week, and the offices just stayed empty. So that we weren't particularly good at optimizing around space use before the pandemic, so I doubt we're going to get very good at optimizing around it post-pandemic.
Right. Do you think that there's a danger that the agglomeration benefits of cities would be lost because people aren't coming in to work in their offices?
It's interesting. I think it is certainly true that the agglomeration benefits are a function of how many people are there. And if fewer people show up there, the agglomeration benefits decrease. The thing that I feel safest about in terms of the future of wealthy world cities is the city as playground, the city as place of pleasure, the city as consumer city. That feels like it has no danger whatsoever facing it. I mean, 250 years ago or so, when Dr. Samuel Johnson said that when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life because there's all in London that life can afford. He was right then. He's still right. And that's an enduring thing. I don't think there's any danger of any of this in the developing world. Right. I don't think the Zoom thing is particularly relevant for most of the developing world. If anything, it's just pure benefit. because the higher end people can Zoom with people in Europe, people in the US. And so that's a pure asset. But I mean, even in the wealthy world, right? I mean, Zoom is a very elite thing. I mean, in May 2020, when sort of we went in, you know, the high point of working remotely from because of COVID, 68.9% of Americans with advanced degrees were working remotely. 5% of high school dropouts were working remotely. I mean, it just wasn't a thing for less educated Americans. And so the more that the future is Zoom oriented, it's likely to be a force that only increases inequity. One of the things to be slightly careful about with surveys is I tend to think online surveys tend to, in some cases, radically overstate the level of remote work because you get people who are comfortable being online. The current population survey data, which is done by the department, which is done by the sort of U.S. government, that seems to suggest stability to about 10% of people fully remote. And if anything, slightly increasing numbers heading, looking like it's going from 8% to 12% of people doing remote part-time. So, you know, maybe between the two groups, maybe a quarter of the U.S. population with some degree of regularity.
There's a few ideas knocking around about managing cities, and one of them is the 15-minute city. Do you have any views on that?
I do, in fact, have views on the 15-minute city. And while I certainly applaud the idea that, you know, we're going to have land use regulations that are such that it's easy to put residences and workplaces and cafes and stores all in the same neighborhood, there are wonderful things about the 15-minute city. The vision of, you know, neighborhoods being full of lots of different amenities is great. The ability for us to have access to lots of things without driving a car, that's fantastic. But the view that we should basically see ourselves as being citizens of a sort of small neighborhood rather than citizens of an entire metropolis, that feels deeply dangerous to me, especially in America with its history of profound racial and income segregation. Together with Carlo Ratti and a series of other co-authors, we put together a paper looking at essentially mobility using cell phones and the 15-minute city. And what we find in the U.S. is actually the more that rich people, elites, live within their 15-minute area, they actually integrate more. So in an elite setting, it's not a terrible thing. If you're, you know, coming from a poor area, if you're an African-American, the 15-minute city experience is one that involves just much more experienced segregation for them. And so if you want a city that's integrated, you want to eschew the 15-minute city. You want to embrace a metropolis-wide kind of vision of the city, not one that focuses on small little neighborhoods.
I was very surprised when I saw a headline in The Economist, which was talking about the death spiral of the city, because The Economist is usually very measured and British in the way that it speaks about these things. But it was a podcast that you took part in. I mean, you don't see a death spiral for the city, do you?
No, I don't. Look, I mean, there are particular American cities that were challenged pre-pandemic and will be challenged post-pandemic. You know, the American Rust Belt cities that were relatively low property values, significantly below construction costs, right? A significant decline in office rents could just mean sort of very large levels of vacancies in those places that will persist. And one way to think about it is, if you think that this, the Zoom, the remote work, the hybrid, whatever it is, will lead to a substantial reduction in commercial rents in New York, San Francisco, London, they're still going to be occupied because those rents are going to be high enough to cover the costs. In Buffalo and Cleveland, they might not be. And so those areas, death spirals are more worrisome. In general, death spirals are less worrisome in the UK because the central government doesn't let it happen. In a highly federalized structure like the US, right, the federal government does not see its job as saving, you know, Cleveland, right? That's not it. That's not its job. The UK government does see its job as saving Liverpool. So it's just a different thing. And also, like, the differences in the quality of government aren't as big, the difference in climate aren't as big, right? There are a lot of things which sort of make it particularly hard to bring back declining U.S. cities that are less true, less in the U.K. context.
You've been described as free market by instinct, but is there a place for policy in cities to make them work well?
For sure. I mean, just look, it is certainly true that, you know, I received my PhD at the University of Chicago, and yes, I assert a certain amount of skepticism for many things that government does. But just as there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole, supposedly, right? Once the shells start raining on you, you start praying, right? There's no such thing as a true libertarian in a city. Cities need government. I mean, there are all of these we call spillovers or externalities. Some of them are positive, right? The magical sharing of ideas, but many of them are negative, right? Traffic congestion, crime, contagious disease, all of these things require an effective public sector to manage. And so the idea that we don't have a real, really profound need for government policy to make our cities livable, to make them humane, to make them places of upward mobility, right? All of those things have a profound need for policy. Now, I will say in terms of managing across space, I tend to have my primary view tends to favor spatial neutrality on the part of national government. So I don't actually think that like strong regional policies to aid place A over place B are usually warranted. Also because central governments often screw it up, right? So it's not as if it's, but if you tell me sort of, you know, but when we're thinking about how to make London place a more upward mobility to make it more functional in terms of mobility, all of those things have a strong need for an effective public sector.
So place-based policies is not for you.
Well, I want to distinguish between place-based policies that are fundamentally redistributing from place A to place B versus perhaps having national policies that are place-sensitive. So, for example, you can think about two policies towards affordable housing, one of which is give poor people housing vouchers, which is the government just gives them cash, and secondly, use the national government to encourage housing supply in a particular location. America has some places like Texas where the private sector does a really good job of building like crazy, and extra help subsidizing supply makes very little sense there. Similarly, it makes very little sense in cities like Detroit, which have far more housing than they know what to do with. In these places, it makes sense to do more with vouchers. In other cities, you know, the quantity of housing can be very constrained by regulation. And in those cases, giving people vouchers will just cause the prices to go up, because you have a fixed stock of housing. And so it makes more sense to push on the supply side. I'm not saying we should redistribute from, let's say, a constrained place like Boston, Massachusetts to Texas, or from Texas to Boston, Massachusetts, but you might want different policies in those different areas. Similarly, in the case of, let's say you have a disability policy that both features a base payment and then essentially taxes employment, right? So they say you can't earn if you're receiving disability. Although typically disabled people are able to earn, you could imagine that in places where long-term joblessness is just a really big problem, you might want to make the base payment lower, but do less to tax employment for those areas. So you do less to encourage joblessness in those areas. So in those senses, I think you can have place-sensitive policies, even if you don't view your job as to being like, I'm going to encourage people to move to Wyoming for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, you've gone through an interesting mix of policies, but overall, what's the key to tackling urban homelessness?
So I would differentiate homelessness, which is, of course, deeply related to issues of mental health as well as housing supply, from the more general housing supply problem. So housing supply more generally, I think, is mostly about an issue of getting rid of barriers to building and, you know, figuring out if there are other things that the public sector is doing that are causing construction costs to be higher than they should be. Those are, you know, fundamentally what we could do in this area. In terms of homelessness, if it's, you know, if there's if the people are basically functional and they just can't afford housing, you know, maybe a housing voucher does it in that case. But for many people, it's you know, they're not functional, and it's, you know, there's a whole set of theories around fix housing first, which is a plausible hypothesis. Fixing housing first, I mean, I was talking to the mayor of San Jose, California, about 10 days ago, and their issue of providing housing for homeless, it was costing them $1.2 million a housing unit to provide this. I mean, this is a level of investment that very few cities could possibly contemplate doing. And in his case, like the big gain, which sounded sensible to me, was moving towards very low-cost modular housing. So prefabricated things and just figuring out how to create cheap and maybe even like mobile homes that can actually be, if you're going to fix housing first, rather than 1.2 million, you can do it for tens of thousands rather than less. So, and obviously it's also worthwhile thinking about mental health related interventions or other things that are homelessness related. But homelessness is just a very thorny problem to tackle.
Yeah. In his book, Progress and Poverty, Henry George advocated for an end to private land ownership, and he called it an evil. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, an end to private land ownership is a bit strong. I think you want something. I mean, the George view that you want a land tax has a lot to recommend it, right? So George favored some fraction of the city to be paid for by a land tax, in part because unlike an income tax, the land can't run away, right? Unlike a property tax, which is shaped against the value of the physical structure, a land tax doesn't deter you from building structures in that area. So there's a lot to like about a land tax. I think it's hard if property owners or businesses don't have any stake in the value of their land, because they take a lot of actions which increase the value of their land, and you want them to take those actions, right? I mean, American cities were actually, many of them were built by real estate developers, right? That this basic structure of, you know, creating Chicago out of whole cloth, or creating St. Louis out of whole cloth, or creating, above all, Los Angeles out of whole cloth, the Los Angeles real estate booster community, hoping to benefit from increasing the value of land, made those cities. I like private ownership of land. I just also like a land tax. And I think George was right about that.
If you could summarize what makes one city successful and another one less successful, what would you say?
I have a very simple two-factor model of economic success at the place and the country level. One of which is human capital. So skills, talent, and right at large, right? This is not just about years of education. This is about the talent and inclination to be an entrepreneur. This is about various forms of cultural strength that exist in different areas, but human talent. And the second of which is having reasonable, sensible policies that are, you know, relatively pro-business, pro-entrepreneurship. Those are the two things. Now, you also need a whole other set of policies to attract and retain smart people. Right. That's not it. That doesn't mean like you don't do anything else, but most of the other things are dedicated towards attracting and retaining smart people rather than on any other particular objective. How do you get to that route of having skilled people and relatively sensible policies? There are many different routes towards getting that. I mean, the East Asian route was different from the Scandinavian route, was different from the UK route, which is different from the US route. I mean, the US route is somewhat different in different parts of the region as well. So there's not one way of doing it. I think it's hard to retain talent unless you provide a reasonably pleasant urban area, a reasonably benign public sector towards business and entrepreneurship, and reasonable opportunities for, you know, raising kids and you know, living in a reasonable fashion. I think all of those things are sort of necessary for retaining talent. But it's also true that, you know, there's no one model for this, and there's no one model for successful neighborhoods either. I mean, great cities are frequently archipelagos of neighborhoods that have lots of different variety, and that can be a great attraction for a city.
When you look towards the future, what are the major trends that you see unfolding in urban life?
I think we need to be obsessed by what's happening in the developing world. I think that's to me the most exciting things that are happening in cities are happening in poorer countries, and the most exciting things in poorer countries are happening in cities. And so those areas feel like they're really important to me. I just came from a conference in Washington at the World Bank, which was jointly done with the International Growth Center of the UK International Growth Center, which I co-lead their cities program, which had a lot of really exciting things that were being talked. The mayor of Freetown, Yvonne Aki-Sawyer, I thought was particularly fantastic in terms of her energy that she brought to things. There were things that I hadn't thought about that I learned, but all about sort of urban government. We were often concentrated on things which are very kind of dull but nuts and bolts aspects of making governments better. So how do you do public procurement better, right? How do you, you know, get your minibus jitney system to work without people killing each other, the operators killing each other, right? I mean, sort of basic things around quality of life, I think, that are very exciting and that I think of as sort of central towards improving the quality of life in developing world cities. So I don't know that there's any one thing. I mean, when I think about the US, I continue to think that the state of urban schools is our biggest challenge. The transportation that is so linked to cities is sort of interesting, because for many decades, it felt like we were by and large treading water in transportation, that our cars didn't improve that much. Our trains certainly didn't improve. And in the past 10, 15 years, with the rise of autonomous electric vehicles, It feels like we're in a place of much more change, and that's kind of exciting. GPS-based things. So the way that technology relates to cities is sort of interesting. From the public sector perspective, it's often, it just moves, can move very slowly, and it can be difficult to figure out how to incorporate the technology, especially since a private sector company, you know, can just, if their new technology has come along and it doesn't have workers who know how to handle the technology, they'll just fire some workers and hire some new workers who don't know how to handle it. Governments are much stickier, and so it's much harder to adjust your workforce for the new technologies that come along.
You mentioned looking to the cities of the emerging world and that being where the excitement is. Can you sort of give us an example of something that's excited you?
Sure. So the paper that I've been working on right now is about workplace integration in Brazil. So we have a long tradition in American social science, in Western social science, of thinking about residential segregation. Residential segregation feels like it's really important in lots of ways. And I think it is very important for children. I mean, segregation has a very powerful effect in explaining the differential outcomes for whites and African-American kids. But as recent work using cell phone data by Susan Athey, Matthew Gentkow, and their co-authors have shown, like, experience segregation for adults can be very different than residential segregation. You know, in most American cities, you get up in the morning, you leave your segregated neighborhood, you go to an integrated firm, you interact with lots of different people. And so the neighborhood doesn't matter, but it does matter for kids, right? So that's one thing that I'm because the kids actually don't go to work in an integrated company. They go to a segregated school, they play on a segregated street corner. And so that's understanding this is feels important to me. I've new work with Cody Cook and Lindsay Currier that tries to differentially look at them, the cell phone mobility patterns of poor kids and rich kids, and just documents how much more of a like a life that is disconnected from the marvels of urban areas that the kids of poverty experience, even in wealthy cities. In Brazil, we're specifically looking at the integration of workplace establishments. And this was motivated by, you know, asking whether or not Brazilian cities were serving as engines of opportunity for ordinary people or people who even start in poverty. And the sort of fact that came out of this work was that southern Brazilian cities seem to be doing it a lot better than northern Brazilian cities. That the north, which tends to be poorer, tends to be less educated, tends to be oriented towards natural resources, was just much less well-performing, both in terms of the initial wages, but also the upward mobility that you get. Because one of the sort of core facts about cities is they're not just a level effect, meaning you get higher wages, they're a slope effect, meaning that you get, you're on an escalator that pulls your wages up more quickly if you're in a dense urban area. What we found was the difference was between the north and the south could be sort of completely explained or almost completely explained in a statistical sense by the fact that the southern firms were just much more integrated by skill than the northern firms were. The northern firms were relatively simple, natural resource-related firms that were very tied to, that by and large had less skilled people just work with other less skilled people. This work has since been duplicated in the U.S. It finds the same thing, that actually being around skilled people is just really important in the workplace. Now, we've always known that skills were really important at the neighborhood level. We were less clear that they were sort of central for upward mobility at the individual level, at the firm level. But thinking about what developing world cities end up producing these sort of integrated firms versus which ones produce firms in which less skilled workers are kind of isolated laborers who don't actually integrate with anybody else, that feels like an interesting, important thing to understand better.
When you talk about segregation in these cities, are you talking about racial segregation or are you talking about income?
Skill.
Skills.
Skill. But you can sometimes proxy for skill by income. It's also true. But I don't typically have race data from the administrative data on these things. I have data on income or other things which are proxied for skill. Another thing that I've been doing that I'm excited by is using Uber's data from cell phone records to measure the bumpiness of roads. And so I can tell you how different the bumpiness is of all types of roads in the U.S. and how much bumpier African-American roads that African-Americans ride on are from roads that whites ride on. And we can even use how much people slow down on bumpy roads to measure how much they dislike bumpiness in some sense and how much the social losses are from bumpiness. And I can also tell you that in 4 out of 5 cities that we were able to get data on, American cities aren't targeting their repaving at all. So we're not repaving the bumpier roads more quickly. And I would love to see how this works out in Johannesburg or Nairobi or other places like that.
I just love that. I love that. Potholes in Britain, we call them potholes, is a very civic issue
It's a big deal. And you know, we have big data that enables us to measure them, and we should be not just measuring them, but actually using that big data to target our public resources.
So listen, one last question. Tell me, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of cities?
I am by nature an absolutely incurable optimist. So there's no, you know, I'm not trying to persuade anyone on your podcast that they should be optimistic. The only thing I will tell them is being optimistic is a much better way to go through life. That actually feeling full of hope is just a much better way to wake up in the morning and be excited about what you're doing, rather than calibrating yourself to look for doom in the horizons. And I would say, you know, I mean, the last 3,000 years have been a pretty great run. I mean, humanity connected in cities has done absolutely miraculous things, whether or not from, you know, the miracles of 5th century Athens, you know, the plays of Aeschylus, Euripides, Sophocles, Aristophanes, the magic of 15th century Florence, you know, the painting of Masaccio and Botticelli, Fra Filippo Lippi, Frangelico, you know, the amazing things that happened in 19th century London in so many ways, right? I mean, the history of urban areas is stunning. And so there's just a lot to be optimistic about.
Well, Ed, thank you so much. I so appreciated your data on bumpy roads. That was my highlight.
The name of the paper is Infrastructure Inequality. And if you just Google Glaser Infrastructure Inequality, any of your readers, any of your listeners can find it.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Janet.
Forward Thinking is a production of the McKinsey Global Institute. Find us online at mckinsey.com/MGI or at mckinsey_MGI on Twitter. Forward Thinking is hosted by Janet Bush and me, Michael Chui. Our audio engineer is Colin Warren.
If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, or review us wherever you get your podcasts.
The opinions expressed by podcast guests are their own and do not reflect the views or opinions of the McKinsey Global Institute. References to specific products, services, or organizations do not constitute any endorsement or recommendation by MGI.